Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody at the Independent Corner. This is Jonathan Moody, your host, and with me tonight is my co-host tonight is Vittorio Treppo, who's a good friend of mine, and the guest tonight is Jim Bride. How are you doing,
Hello.
Jim?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Jim has directed the cult hit sensation Don't Go in the Woods Alone and Hell Riders, as well as like Lady Street Fighter and a few others. So wait, we've got another caller. I think this, hold on 1 second. Me 818, hello.
Hey, it's Chris.
All right, Chris Watson's here.
Hello, Chris.
Hey, how's it going, Jim?
Pretty good, pretty good. I was just telling him about the about Freaks and the CIA showing.
Oh, yeah, are you going?
I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent.
I want to see Milo the pretzel boy.
Is there somebody who looks like a pretzel?
But yeah, he's very flexible, apparently, and he's sort of a contortionist.
Cool.
In the traditional, you know, freak show sense, I believe that's right. So
that's really cool. So I guess, Chris, were you ever a big fan of Don't Go in the Woods Alone?
Yeah. I liked it. I actually became a fan of Jim's because of Hell Riders. I had just randomly picked that up at a video store and could not stop watching it for several years. So. I've still got a beat-up video copy here. That kind of led me to see Don't Go in the Woods.
Yeah, and you've made, what, 4 feature films, Jim?
Well, a few more than that. I made some X-rated films, so there are about a dozen.
you really went into the X-rated,
I started, the first feature, it was something that I wanted to do when I was still at UCLA in the film school. And the budget that I could afford and the film that had a chance to get out before the public was an X-rated film. So that's what I did.
Pretty cool, though. I mean, there's a lot of filmmakers who go dabble into that when they start doing, you know, independent horror films.
Right. Well, at UCLA, when we got there, a friend of mine found the outtakes from Francis Coppola's X-rated film that he made. So it was sort of a joke around there. You know, you go in the editing rooms, you didn't know what you were going to find, other people's projects that they did, you know, outside of UCLA. But they used the equipment in the rooms and things like that.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah.
What do you prefer, making independent horror films or adult films?
Well, I would say independent horror films. Adult films are a little tricky, you know, because, you know, you aren't always in control. So I like the horror films better. But as far as the next film that I make, should I make one, I've got plans to do a sequel to Don't Go in the Woods that we talked a little about, and I've asked Chris to help me out, and on Friday I have to give him a script so we can actually see what we're talking about.
This is Vittorio again. Where do you get some of your ideas? Do you just come up with them, or do you just like read a book or some short stories? Or,
well, usually it's things that are happening. A lot of my films have to do with, you know, what's happening in the world or on television or in books, and So that's why I've been thinking about genetic memory and trying to come up with an idea that would involve that. And something that happened while we were making Don't Go in the Woods, in the cabin that we used, nobody had been up there for 3 years. And, you know, it was an old cabin. They had a big wooden stove, and nobody used it. But I was told by the guy who owned the cabin that if you didn't want the mice to get into any of the food, you had to put it on top of the old iron stove. And sure enough, the stove didn't have to be hot but the mice wouldn't climb up on it to eat the food, no matter how hungry they were. So, and since, you know, mice and rats don't live much longer than 18 months, and usually not that long, there had been several generations since, you know, the mice had experienced a hot stove, but they still didn't get on it, no matter what you left open on top of the stove. They wouldn't climb up. So, you know, the grandchildren were still staying away from the hot stove, even though there was no fire in it, so...
Yeah, that could be an interesting theory. No one's really turned like a Philip K. Dick short story into a horror movie.
Right. And that's, I was thinking, you know, that some, you know, usually what you see is, you know, the family curse. So it's not far from that, but it's, you know, something that occurs that maybe shouldn't occur, or, you know, that's fascinating that the protagonist would not be in control of. I like that idea.
What advent of, I guess, movie making do you find most interesting now, especially with, like, you know, all the digital editing technologies and how people are using, like, digital and all that stuff? And
well, I don't know. I was always looking at the most advanced things I could for years and years, and then with Don't Go in the Woods, everything, you know, really got simple and basic, you know, old style. And now I'm considering maybe, you know, trying, you know, videotape more for the theatrical thing. Because I like the whole idea of holding on to the, you know, the 35-millimeter film. I enjoy that. So, you know.
Is that actually cheaper than the digital video, or is it just because, you know, sometimes...
Well, yeah, it depends on your approach. It can be cheaper. In Don't Go in the Woods, I found a company that had, you know, would buy short ends of 35-millimeter stock, and they would hold it in the refrigerator for so long, and after a certain time, they would sell it for silver, and that's where I got the film for Don't Go in the Woods. I bought it at reclaimed silver prices because they were getting ready to throw it out. I said, wait a minute, let me send you a check. I want all that film. So that's what I used to shoot Don't Go in the Woods.
Oh, wow.
And, so that way it was cheaper because, you know, all the stock only cost about $400.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, you know, that's thinking all the time. Of course, now those companies really aren't in business anymore, but you can still get, you know, short in stock, but not that much. It used to be.
Does Kodak still deal with that, or are they like one of those companies that have kind of, because I know Kodak, you know, for the longest time has been having financial difficulties.
And yeah, Kodak and Fuji are still doing it. So, and the studio labs are mainly, you know, getting involved in the satellite distribution and all that.
Yeah.
So they're trying to, you know, go digital and, you know, keep up with the world, but they're still shooting on film. And
have you used Fuji before? And if so, how does that work? Or how did you find it?
Well, it's, one is a little blue and the other is a little green. That's all I... That's
okay.
When I was using it, that was the story. But, you know, it's just sort of a slight tint. But they've solved all their, you know, developing problems, and, you know, you can barely tell the difference.
Yeah, because I'm kind of a photographer / developer, and I've found that on still photography, there is a difference on Fuji and Kodak. Fuji gives you a better light outside, while Kodak will give you a slightly better look on indoor shots.
Mm-hmm.
So, at least that's my...
Well, I guess that really hasn't changed then.
So. Who was your director of photography for Don't Go in the Woods Alone?
Well, it was a guy who came from Seattle along with... a couple of the cast members, and somebody that I had worked with in L.A. was there, and he just invited people to come along, and he came along and got involved in the picture just because, you know, somebody was around and we needed somebody to appear in the film.
What I noticed was you used a lot of the killer's POV shot. Right?
Yeah. Well, that was sort of a standard thing for a horror film, so that's why I did it, you know. It was something that was sort of the form for a horror film, to use the camera POV. People don't do it as much anymore, but it was sort of an early cliche, and I really enjoyed that cliche. So.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of see it, but I guess with, you know, with digital these days, a lot of people are going, you know, it's handheld most of the time anyway. So.
Right. And I meant to mention Hank Zinman, the DP's name. Sorry, Hank.
I'm sure he forgives you.
Yes. So he's had a very successful career. I mean, he came to Salt Lake from Seattle, and he was shooting news footage, and he came to L.A. after the film was over. Or, you know, the production was over in Salt Lake, and he's been sort of shooting news material, you know, on assignment for the last how many years, since 81. So he's very successful. He gets to travel all over the world. So.
Yeah, sweet gig if he can get it.
Oh, yeah, he's doing, you know, they need him all the time. He just works like a maniac.
Okay, well, this is Vittorio signing off. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Have a good evening.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Vittorio. And Chris, I wanted to know what your thoughts on a lot of his films are. Hello, Chris.
I loved Hellriders, like I said, and I don't know if you already talked about it, but the way he was able to make Adam West and Tina Weiss look like the stars of the movie with so few days. It was amazing when I heard that. Like, that just floored me.
Yeah, exactly.
I tried.
It was only in one day, right, that you actually shot the Adam West and Tina Louise stuff.
That's correct, yeah, just the one day, and everything was designed around and scheduled around using them, you know, and finishing it in that single day. So we had all these little tiny sets, you know, would shoot up at the sky and, you know, all those sorts of things. And we matched the stand-ins or, you know, people who portrayed the stars, but they would be in long shots or looking away, and then you would cut to the close-ups and it would be the stars.
That's really cool.
Well, I one of the things I had noticed is that, you know, in the studio films, they would send the camera on location, and if you look closely, you can see that the main characters are actually played by somebody else, but they're so far away. So I thought I would do it, in the extreme. That way we could spend a little bit less money.
Well, you know, these days, like independent filmmakers, and especially micro-budget filmmakers, they will take a star that's been in a bunch of stuff or whatever, like a cult star, and they put them in their movie, and their movie, you know, the cult star will cost like $10,000, and they just use them for as like a cameo, but they'll still pull them as like the top build, you know.
Well, the person who's really the master of this, I think, is Chris Watson. Because he's done it in such a way that, you know, I mean, it's like I am in awe, and I really think he's a genius at this. And he's got a lot of stories about using different people and how he affords them. And, you know, now this guy is Mr. Independent. That's why I want him to help me with my sequel of Don't Go in the Woods again.
Oh, is that what it's called now? Don't Go in the Woods again?
Yeah, I have two scripts, and I think Again will be the next title.
Well, I think with the re-release that's coming out April 29th.
Right.
There you go for a plug right there, so people can
go
out.
Thank you. Code Red rides again.
Actually, you know, that's another thing. Do you think you'll ever do a sequel to Hellriders?
Well, I hadn't thought about it, but it's sort of a popular film. And so who knows? I mean, that could happen. I mean, I really like the idea of doing a biker film. And
Adam West is still doing stuff, you know? I mean, I think he's doing stuff with, like, Family Guy.
Yeah. No, so. I like Adam West, and I especially like Tina Louise. I mean, we had a hard time working together, but, you know,
we were
cautious with each other, but we got through it. And one of her good friends and, you know, fans, Sean Chang, you know, is in touch with her all the time, and she's willing to, you know, do the extras on the release and when and if it happens, and would do a sequel. I mean, she's willing to.
Oh, you guys
step
are thinking of doing a, you know, a DVD release of it?
Well, they're trying to get it, but the company that originally released it, sold it so many times, there were bankruptcies, and it was part of Canon's library for a while there when they, you know, got funding through the famous MGM thing, and so I don't know who owns it, and they don't either. It's in the MGM lab, but nobody knows how to get it out, and there's so many claims on it, you know.
Oh, wow.
We will see what happens. I mean,
so how long till it becomes, like, public domain?
Oh, I don't know. That may be a long time. I'm in touch with Renee Harmon's heirs, and they would like to, you know, get it out. And Code Red has found one of the producers who will actually talk about it. But we'll see. Maybe somebody can pull it out.
Hopefully.
So they're working at it. They're always looking for new titles, and they're very good at finding these things.
Now, you did the Hellriders. You also did the Executioners Part 2, which
right.
I think everybody always laughs about, because it's one of the things where, you know, it's a Part 2, but there never was a first part, right?
Right. Well, there was another Executioner film, but it was sort of minor, and it had a lot of play in Europe, but most people just forgot about it. So there was, but we had nothing to do with that film. It came and went. But the company that was interested was an Italian firm, and they put up the money, and they wanted it to be like that film. So that's what it got called.
Huh.
So.
Okay. So it just randomly became Part 2 of a movie that.
Yeah, they already had the artwork, so.
That sounds like one of those, you know, low budget companies. You know, that sounds
right.
Like the scene in Ed Wood. You know, where, you know, it's like, do you guys have a script? No, but we have a poster.
That's it.
So.
Because that's how independents used to sell their movies, you know. They would get a poster, and then if they were really wanted to go out on a limb, they would shoot a trailer, and then they would sell it to the, you know, the local distributors around the country. And that's how they would raise their money.
I believe that's still how a lot of independent filmmakers do it. They do marketing first, and
yeah.
Then all of a sudden, you know, buy this movie from us, and
yeah,
you know.
I started doing it the opposite way when I started. I would make the movie and then try to figure out how I was going to sell it. So then I would do the, you know, come up, change the title and redo the trailer, and so one of the things I did is I invented an extra carradine, because one of the films, people said, well, I don't know if we can play that. It doesn't have a name. I said, oh, yeah, I didn't tell you that one of the Carradine brothers is in it? So I made up a Carradine.
A Bobby Carradine? Oh, that's, well, I guess there would be Robert Carradine. So.
Trace.
Trace Carradine?
Trace Carradine.
Is that a real? I mean, did you just ask somebody to play to?
Well, there was a character, and we just changed his name. We gave him a stage name that was Trace Carradine.
Nice.
Right. So anyway, it worked.
And you got the movie out there, right?
Yeah, because the people who were booking it said, "Well, is this really a Carradine brother?" I said, "Well, of course it is." And they said, "You're right, it is," because they knew they could book it. So.
Nice. And I was going to say, I just saw this, that apparently Aldo Ray was in Executioner Part 2.
That's true.
And he was actually a good friend of Ed Wood's, I believe.
Ah.
You know, okay. You didn't know that?
No, I didn't know that he was a good friend, but I did know that that one of the ex-producers that I worked for originally had Ed Wood making his films.
Oh, nice.
They made little short silent films that were put on a loop for bookstores. And, yeah, it turns out he was good friends of Ed Wood, because I thought that Ed Woods was sort of a comical character, and this person got really upset with me because he had a lot of respect for Ed Wood. And so I had to back down. I didn't mean it. I was just joking.
So that's, you know, he is kind of a comical guy, and then the movie
That's what I thought, you know, but, you know, I didn't realize he was a dancer until, you know, the guy who wrote the book had come up with some home movies of Ed Wood, and you know, he was all in black, and you know, you could tell the way he moved that he was like a dancer, and I hadn't realized that, but now I see where his sensibility comes from.
Being able to bounce around and do that.
Yeah.
So anyway, Chris, what do you have to ask?
Did you know that Milo the Pretzel Boy is a guitarist and he's in a band?
I did not know that.
Okay. Well, I just thought I'd add that, and we could talk about Milo as opposed to.
I've got a question from the audience, actually, from a chatter. Saul Buffy. Has to ask, why is Angie Brown's name boxed in the credits for the film?
Well, the reason that was is this is Angie Brown's first film that she appeared in. And she was there with, she came on the set with a friend, and we decided, you know, she wanted to know if she could be in the film. I said, sure. And since there wasn't a lot of money involved, the one thing she wanted was to have her name in a box, because it was a popular thing when movie stars would be in a low budget film. They really couldn't expect to have first billing because they'd only be there for a day, but they would get their name in a box. So it would be down at the end of the credits, but in a box it would separate it, you know, it's just a little point of recognition. So.
Oh, well, that was a good question, too. I was wondering that, too. It was just kind of a random thing when I saw it.
Yeah.
But, so. Thank you, Saul Buffy. Another thing is, you know, there's a lot of people who do, like, these low-budget, no-budget slasher films, and I think a lot of them kind of mimic, Don't Go in the Woods Alone. Like, you ever seen the movie Camp Blood?
No, I haven't seen it. But that's the first time I met Chris. That's what we were talking about. He said that Don't Go in the Woods was worthy of copying. And
I've done it. So Water Party is basically Don't Go in the Woods with a midget.
Right. So I think Chris can have a career copying Don't Go in the Woods. I mean, he's very successful, with these low budget films, and I thought I was low budget, but he's really low budget. He is
so
independent.
How did you guys meet?
Huh?
How did you guys meet?
Well, let's see.
I think I fanboyed him first.
Yeah.
And then just kept in touch after that.
Right. You invited me to a screening in one of your films.
Yeah.
And did you not expect, you know, him to actually show up, Chris?
Oh, of course not. You never. you can't even get people from the movie to show up. You don't expect a director you have a lot of respect for to show up. So it's always cool, and he's one of the biggest supporters I think we have. So.
Yeah,
it's really cool.
Well, I like Chris's approach, and when my friends and I, my contemporaries, when we first started out, that's sort of how we, you know, got going. We would, you know, have screenings for each other and invite other people. And there was a theater on Sunset, independent movies, and you know, we would get our short films together and then go book them in the theater, you know, book a feature-length program, but all of short films. So we did all those things. And you do what you have to do to get people to show up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think Saul Buffy has some more questions. Let me, you know, let him know, you know, let him know that he can ask more if they, you know.
Oh, sure.
As long, you know, just keep asking questions as long as you want to, and we will try to answer them as best, you know, best we can. Or people can call in, you know. We might have a special guest call in.
Uh-huh.
That is a fan of your work, so.
A special guest. Now, you're talking about a fan of Chris's work, right?
No, a fan of your work.
Oh, my goodness. Okay,
yes.
Well. It's not Barack Obama, is it?
Well, we could only hope, right? I can't tell you who it is yet.
Okay.
If they don't show up, I will. You know.
You'll tell me, right?
I will tell you at the end, but.
Okay.
You know, so you won't be like, oh man, who is it? another question that Saul Buffy had was, is it a sequel to The Forest?
To The Forest?
Yeah.
No, we actually we made it at the same time. I knew of Don Jones, but I didn't know what he was doing, and he didn't know what I was doing. I was in Salt Lake, and he was in L.A., and, you know, and a lot of the shots are similar, you know. So it just happened that way.
Because for some reason, the Australia video title is The Forest 2.
Yes. Well, I mean, that happens, you know. They had The Forest first, and, you know, they just want people to come to the movie, so they change the title. So if they know people will show up to see Forest 2, then they're gonna do that. It's an advertising gimmick. And they
it's
still
so
do
wrong,
it.
Though. Because then you'll never know.
Yeah.
You'll be like, oh, no, it's The Forest 2. Well, I didn't
right.
do that.
Well, when we played at the Grindhouse, you know, show, they played together because Code Red has both films.
Oh.
They have Woods and The Forest, and so.
Nice. The Forest, wasn't that the movie where the forest attacked?
Well, no, it's the weird family out in the woods, and, you know, people get killed by the, I don't know, possessed people or whatever it is.
There was some movie that where some people just got attacked by
I think
the woods actually attacked.
Yeah,
them.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen a few of those. Those are interesting. I like those. So I think The Ruins is like that. You know, something in the only it's the vines I think that attack people if they're, you know, plants or something.
If anybody wants to call in, feel free to call in at 1-646-915-8693. And don't feel shy. If you want to ask a question, just, you know, call in and ask something. So, or you can ask in the chat room. Just go to blogtalkradio.com/JonathanMoody, where you're listening to it right now. You should just check in the chat room. So I'm guessing because the chat room's been kind of bumping, you know, before. Like, it had a lot of people coming in and out. So
Hopefully
this will be a pretty good show. Hopefully a good amount of people listen to it live. And,
okay.
You know, you never know with these things. You know?
I know.
Actually, you know, one of my questions I've been wondering is, are you a fan or a friend of Albert Pyun?
Let's see. I worked for, the distributor that he did some work with. So I know who you're talking about, but I think we've met once, maybe twice. Because they would be coming in. I was cutting trailers at Group One, so.
The guy that, you know, the Saul Buffy, wanted me to let you know that that he made a small movie with his friends inspired by Don't Go in the Woods called Terror in the Forest.
Ah, okay.
Do you know of that movie? Thank you.
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it.
I think it might be on YouTube. Right.
Okay.
But so I think it's pretty cool that that's the thing. You get so many movies that are inspired.
Right.
You know.
Well, I'm glad that I could inspire somebody. That's good.
Yeah, exactly.
Other than Chris, but you know. But Chris is a genius, so you know, he can do it on his own.
Oh.
Yeah. So
He says it has a MySpace. So
he has what?
He has a MySpace for Terror in the Forest.
Ah, okay.
So it has its own MySpace. So yeah,
wow.
Tell us the MySpace, and we will be sure to you know, pimp it out so people can go check that out.
Okay.
And when I guess you can too,
sure.
Jim.
Yeah.
You know, you can see what. And I think it does have a YouTube, because
okay.
I think I saw somewhere on YouTube that people were talking about that. But right. It's myspace.com/terror _in_the_forest. So,
okay, you're going to have to repeat that for me.
myspace.com/terror_in_the_forest. So terror
okay.
in the forest, but with the underscores.
Okay. All right.
So hopefully people can go check that out, and I'll add it too, and whatnot. And hopefully you'll get a lot more people. You know, if you add yours and comment, people can come check yours out too, Jim.
Okay.
As far, are you a fan of MySpace as far as filmmakers go?
I'm there. Chris is my buddy.
Yes.
And I guess Brad. And, yeah.
And me. So.
And you, right.
Yeah,
that's where I get your emails, yeah.
Yeah, that's where I found your email. I was like, oh. I didn't even think you'd have a MySpace. But I was like, oh, man, James got a MySpace, so I got to.
Well, Chris invited me, and I couldn't resist.
Invited you on MySpace, or?
Yeah.
Huh.
Be a pal, he said. I said, okay.
You know, because and the thing is, Chris, have you always been a MySpace guy?
Me, no. I was forced into it.
It seemed like it, because the one time I talked to you about it, you're just like, I really don't like this thing. You know, I think I talked to you on the phone one time. You're like, no, I don't like MySpace. It just kind of started doing it, and you know.
Yeah, it seems like you almost have to have it anymore for PR, but
it really does
that,
help, though.
Yeah.
I know that the band that Milo, the Pretzel Boy, is in, they have their, of course, they have a MySpace site for their music.
So Pretzel Boy is in a band?
Yes, he is in the Chuck Dukowski Sextet. And that's CD6. So Chuck was one of the founding members of Black Flag, and he has a band. So So the
cool,
pretzel though. The Pretzel Boy's mother is the singer in the band. So
that is awesome.
I thought you'd appreciate that.
Yeah, it's just that's an interesting topic right there.
Right.
Apparently, Terror in the Forest is already one of my friends. So.
Oh, okay.
Good to know.
Okay.
You see, I've got like 1,000 something, you know, so it's really weird when people randomly, like, add me, and I have no clue,
right.
You know?
Yep.
As far as, do you get a lot of fans who add you on MySpace, Jim?
Not on MySpace so much. It's mainly the Chris Watson coven, you know. But I get a lot through IMDb of people, you know, emailing and talking about things and asking for autographs and pictures and stuff. So I spend out a lot, you know, spend a lot of those. Send a lot out.
Pretty cool. Yeah, I mean, all of Chris's fans and friends and whatnot.
Yeah, so I can tell what they're doing, and you know, the Grindhouse people, the festival, you know, they have a space or MySpace, so I can tell what's going on there. So.
Okay, you know, Saul Buffy also asked, how did Alma Ramos get involved in Don't Go in the Woods?
Alma Ramos, yes. So is this somebody likes Alma? That's the person that let's see, was the last victim we shot, because I decided once I started editing I needed somebody to start out the film with, and so she was a friend of a friend. I was doing a thing with the local theater there, and we were going to shoot like a little trailer. And she was one of the people who agreed to be in the trailer. We just need some, you know, a couple walking in to see a movie, and she was there. So I called her back to be a victim.
Huh. You had a lot of victims in that movie.
Yeah, and Mary Gale Arts, who was in the film, and is a casting director, said that the best person in the film is Alma Ramos, and I should have used her more.
So. She's credited as running girl, though.
Yeah.
Like, she was the first person to get killed, right, in the beginning.
In the picture, and the last person to be shot, yeah.
Oh, okay.
The last person filmed, because I said, uh-oh, I need somebody right away here. Get it going.
To kind of get the thing starting, right?
Right.
Which I noticed, like, all right, I know Garth, how do you pronounce his last name?
Eliason.
Eliason.
Yeah.
Garth Eliason had written the script, which I'm wondering how, like, close you were to the writing.
Oh, okay. You know, where you get ideas, there was a guy in Salt Lake at the university who had just published a book in like 79-80 in Salt Lake. He published a book about urban myths, urban legends. I think that was the title even. And one of the urban legends or local legends where I grew up in the piney woods of East Texas was about the Wild Man. And these were people who were, you know, there was more than one. There's sort of a tradition there for hundreds of years where people would sort of leave society, become a little strange, and go live out in the woods and, you know, run around nude and, you know. So I thought I wanted to include that. And then there was a book about the Hunter's Moon. It was sort of a interesting book, about some killer out in the woods and chases the hunters, and the hunters become hunted. And this agent friend of mine you know, called me and said, you know, ask me what I was up to in Salt Lake. And I said I was thinking about writing a horror film. And one of his clients was Garth Eliason. He said, wait, you don't have to think anymore. I've got the perfect script for you. And sure enough, I liked it. And we just made it fit the budget and, you know, the locations. So that's how we did it.
Are you able to disclose the budget?
Sure. The budget started out, we got it in the lab for under $100,000, like $20,000, something like that, tops. But by the time it was finished, it was well over $100,000, of course.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, because then other people got involved in terms of distributors, and they, you know, fronted the money to get it, you know, finished, get it out.
Cool. So, like, are you able to have any, like, other screenings for the film itself?
Yeah, there's one coming up. Let's see, in Austin, Texas, and I'm going to be there on June the 12th at the Alamo Draft House. And I think Darren Miller is looking for the opportunity to have a screening in end of this month or the beginning of May, something like that. I haven't heard if they found a place to do it yet or what the things are. So, Chris, have you heard any more about that?
I haven't heard any more about it, no.
Okay. I know they were trying to get it at the New Beverly Theater, but I don't know.
So Darren Miller from CKY, Darren Miller?
Yes. The,
wow.
The Woods super fan. So.
All right, well, I'll let you know that that may very well be the person who might call it.
Ah,
yeah,
okay.
Who might. I haven't heard a word back. Have you, Chris?
I haven't heard any more, no.
Well, I mean, I talked to Felissa, but
yeah.
She said back, you know, she left me a voicemail a couple days ago saying she would come on. But then
okay.
I left her a message just like tonight, and
right.
I haven't heard a word back yet. So.
Well, I don't know. Maybe they're out trying to book that theater for the screening.
That would be
great. It played in Seattle too, but I missed that one. I was going to go, but I had to go to Texas.
So yeah, I mean, I've heard that Darren was a fan and has like a poster.
Oh yeah.
You know, so that's really kind of a cool thing, I think. Are you a fan of CKY and stuff like that? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, although, you know, of course, CD6, you know, has got all my attention, but that's just because of Milo.
Oh. Okay.
He's a nice guy.
We should book Milo on the show sometime.
Right, and he could do his contortions and tell people what he was doing, I guess. You could explain it.
I don't know if that would be as much fun.
Okay.
I don't know, because, you know, step-by-step contortionist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, there's a couple questions that some people have been asking. Saul Buffy once again asked, how much blood did you use for the film?
Well, quite a bit, actually. We did use a lot of blood, so it's an, you know, in the area of gallons. And when we first started the victims, we tried different mixtures. You know, we used the Karo syrup and the coloring, but the sweat would run and dilute it, and it was a problem. You had to keep dumping it on. So we finally found the perfect combination of blood. I had, you know, the old Technicolor blood, but that's so messy because it's basically lipstick and glycerin. And so we came up with the barbecue sauce blood, and that I understand that Chris has used that too, but I hadn't realized that it was so good. We used Kraft, the non-chunky kind, so and it's so good because the blood sets up just like blood does. It clots, and you know, put a lot of red dye in it. It looks like blood, and it's barbecue sauce. So, and we had it at different, you know, thicknesses because we had to pump some, and then others had to, you know, be on the victims and clot up, and it just looked better. So it would go through the various stages of blood and be pretty, you know, it was very effective, I thought.
That's a pretty good idea, though. Barbecue sauce as blood.
Right. Because it worked, you know. It's like, oh, I discovered something, but so did everybody else.
I had used ketchup once.
Ah.
But it looked really, really ridiculous.
I know that in black and white films, a lot of people used the Hershey chocolate syrup.
Chocolate syrup, yeah. And
yeah,
that,
it really
those
works.
Work, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it does.
I wonder if that's what Hitchcock used.
Good question. I wouldn't doubt it.
I mean, why not? You know?
Yeah.
And it runs when it's, you know, when water hits it, so.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I think that'll work. Also, we have another question from a person named Ritter Fan on here.
Okay.
Have you been approached about a Don't Go in the Woods remake? And if not, would you approve of one being made?
I was approached once, and I held back, but sure, I would approve it, sure.
You would approve it? I think, well, I mean, I don't know if this is right or not, but doesn't, you know, didn't you say earlier that right now the rights are up in the air, right? Like nobody knows who actually...
For Don't Go in the Woods.
Hellriders
is the one that's up in the air.
But I didn't know if Don't Go in the Woods.
I have the rights to Don't Go in the Woods.
Okay, so so I guess you didn't. Fork over your rights when you made the movie, right? You didn't. You made sure to.
That's correct. Yeah, the contract was for like 7 years or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, so that's another thing. I guess when you do those pictures for hire movies, like, you know, Executioners and Hellriders. You know.
Yeah, I was, Renee Harmon, who starred in Lady Street Fighter, had a contract, and she said, Jim, we should need to make a movie. I said, sure, I'll be there. So I just showed up and did it. So it was her script, and although I did rewrite Hellriders, but
you did rewrite it?
Yeah, I did a rewrite, but I wasn't the only one. Everybody was rewriting because the Italian company that was putting up the money would be in communication and say, well, we want this or we want that, and so it changed every other week. So it would shoot like 3 days and then wait for more money. And they would say, well, we want more of this or want more of that. And they were selling it as they were going along. And, you know, the theaters were saying, well, you know, could you do this? Or other, distributors in other countries said, well, we would like this. And so it got changed, you know, it got added, whatever they wanted.
Now, I guess, did Friday the 13th actually come out after Don't Go in the Woods Alone, or?
Well, it came out before, and there was, I can't remember which number Friday the 13th is the one that, let's see, I was showing everybody Don't Go in the Woods, and I was told by the head of the company that, wait a minute, it looks just like our new film. So,
one of the Friday the 13th?
Yeah. Or the guy had, you know, saw that there were similarities. He didn't really make
Sean
the
S.
film.
Cunningham?
He was just an executive there.
Oh, it wasn't Sean S. Cunningham who... Have you met Sean?
No, I haven't. I enjoy his work, but I haven't met him.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard, we've actually had on my show before. We've had his son on the show. You know, Sean, from what I've heard, is, you know, he's a pretty good guy about everything. Everybody makes, like, these slasher films these days. And,
right.
You know, I mean, really, especially in no-budget world, it's kind of a dime a dozen, so.
Right.
Which is great. I think that a lot of people, you know, have definitely original ideas. Mm-hmm. And as your movie, as Don't Go in the Woods Alone, has shown, it's got a lot of the stereotypical characters.
Oh yeah.
And stuff. You know, there's the sheriff. You know,
you have to have a sheriff.
Apparently so. I haven't really noticed that before until I started, like, watching them again and again. You know, every horror film I see these days has a sheriff somewhere.
Right, I know.
I just watched a werewolf movie. I don't know if you've ever seen it, called Beast of Bray Road again. And
no, that one I haven't seen, no.
Have you seen that, Chris?
I saw about 20 minutes of it.
Aw.
Aw.
I know the director, so I'm a little...
I didn't say it was bad. I just saw it 20 minutes of it.
Oh, okay. Well, it's on Sci-Fi all the time, so...
Oh, okay.
You know, I'm sure you guys will catch it someday if you guys
watch
Sci-Fi.
So the sheriff in Don't Go in the Woods was somebody that I met in the first grade, so...
He's like an old friend of yours? Or?
He's an old friend who's worked as a DJ forever and ever. When we were in high school, he was, you know, working on the side as a DJ. So when we made the movie, he wanted to be in a movie, so he came out to Salt Lake. And he had brought his own uniform. He was a reserve, you know, officer out in West Texas when he was working there, so. He brought his own uniform.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing I wanted, you know, another thing I wanted to ask was about the, you know, you shot, was that actually in a police station that you guys shot it at?
No, the family that owned the cabin had a film lab where they did slides and training films for the government. And, we used the big lab. So we set up their desk and, you know, the one of the back rooms as the, you know, cells, and it was the hospital and the jail. The exterior is actually a real, you know, courthouse, sheriff's office, but the interior was us, you know, the hospital and the jail were the same building. So we were shooting in a big building where they did film work.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Saul Buffy also asked, how long did it take to... did the whole film take to film?
To shoot or to...
To shoot, yeah.
To shoot. Well, it was... there were two stages of shooting. There was like 2 weeks... of shooting with the full cast, and then there were weekend shoots prior to that, shooting victims. So we started out that way, shooting with very limited crew, and you know, one person would come out and they would do their scene, and they were killed and got all the blood out there, and then we'd come back the next week. So
cool.
Find some other victim.
Yeah, that's another thing. Was it written that way? Because it seemed like there was a lot of random characters in the movie.
Right. Yes, it was. It was written that way so that it could be made, and you know, as cheaply as possible, because there wasn't a lot of money. But so the schedule fit, you know, the budget, and you know, the structure of the story did as well.
And there was a lot of characters. I mean, there was probably like...
Well, the reason there were a lot of characters is because there had to be lots of victims. I mean, that was my approach. See, in the Roger Corman...
Oh, hello? I think we just lost Jim.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, that's weird. Maybe his phone just cut off. Hopefully he will call back in a second. because we were hearing something kind of cool. So Chris, how do you like this interview so far?
It's good. It's great.
It's great to hear all this stuff. No, you just did a interview with Dead Pit and stuff. So, not recently, but kind of semi-recently. So, it's cool to hear that him come on another show and talk about everything. And everybody can check out the movie "Don't Go in the Woods Alone" at Netflix right now because they have the instant viewing. So you can watch it instantly on your computer. Right. And are you going to buy the new release or get the new release?
This is actually the first I heard of a new release of it. Do you know what the extras are or anything? Did he say?
Because wasn't the original release have a lot of extras in it? Period?
Yeah. There was a ton of extras in the first Code Red release.
So I'm wondering...
I have that version.
Yeah, so I'm wondering what the second release is going to have. It doesn't say, I don't think, on Netflix. Let me check it out, just to make sure. But I don't think it says. But we'll find out if Jim can call in.
Yeah.
And so to tell us what's going on. I'm guessing his phone clicked off. Hello?
Probably so.
Okay. Making sure that you don't click off, because then uh-oh. You know, I hope that they don't just start kicking people off the show. Let me make sure people can actually call in.
All right.
I'm gonna call in on my cell phone, see if people can actually call in, because that would suck if my show's acting up. Oh, it looks like we've got him back. Hold on 1 second.
We fell in a hole there. I wasn't responding to anybody. So
yeah.
I continued the show without you and had a wonderful time entertaining myself.
You were kicked off for some reason or another.
No, I was vamping, apparently with myself. So
that was kind of weird.
Yeah.
So anyway, do you know where you were at?
Where I was?
Before
it went away?
Yeah.
Oh, we were talking about some particular thing about the number of characters in Don't Go in the Woods.
Yeah, so...
And the victims just sort of unroll.
Like the guy in the wheelchair.
Oh, yeah.
Which, me and Vittoria, we were watching, I was like, guy in a wheelchair. And I was thinking, if it were today, it would be... a Stephen Hawking type guy.
Right. Yeah, I would have enjoyed that. I was inspired by, the handicap access laws. And there was something in the paper about, at that time, about wheelchair access in public parks. And that's what made me think of it.
Huh.
I said, well, that's who hasn't been a victim in this movie yet. It's a guy in a wheelchair.
Yeah, exactly. And
was the sound man.
So, was he?
Yeah, so he got to do that routine.
Was he actually in a wheelchair or?
No, that was the wheelchair that we used as a dolly.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So and that was another question I was going to ask, because I was talking to, when I was talking to Vittorio about it, I said that, I was wondering if you guys actually shot with a dolly or...
Well, we basically
used... Poor man's dolly.
Yeah, poor man's dolly. But we did spend a lot of time digging out spaces in the side of the hill so we could dolly back and forth. So whenever we set up a dolly, we'd use plywood and, dug into the ground on the side of the hills and put it in. So whenever we would lay down a section of plywood to make a dolly track... we would always shoot at least 3 scenes using that track because it took so long to do it. So we would set up 3 scenes to be shot using it. So,
one question that Chris and I were wondering, because Chris, this is the first time Chris heard that there was a re-release of the DVD coming out.
Yes. Yes,
now,
there is, because, yeah.
Are there a lot of extras on it, or?
No, it's the same thing. It's just that Code Red had a contract with, a distributor for getting it into the stores, and the distributor didn't want to supply, didn't want to make a lot of copies, and so people were always asking for it and not being able to find copies. So they found another arrangement. So it's one of the companies that, goes through the same Uber company. The bigger company didn't want to, the contract was up, and they didn't want Code Red to take the movie away because they knew they could sell more. So they just said, oh, you'll like this company. They'll treat you right. And so they introduced them and set it up, and now they're going to re-release it, get it into stores all over again, because apparently people are still looking for it.
Okay. Ritter fan asked this. He says, what are your thoughts about Don't Go being on the list of video nasties? Do you think it deserves it? And any thoughts on it finally getting passed?
Well, I thought that was interesting because, see, I didn't really understand how that had worked. So I had heard that certain people were recognized in England, certain cast members, but I heard the actual truth of it from Stephen Thrower, who wrote the book, Nightmare USA. He's the one who finally explained it to me about how it had worked out. And then, of course, Angie Brown was there in England when it happened, and she was really surprised to see the posters all over town, because they used it, once it made the list, they used it to sell VHSs, the notoriety. So I was very pleased, actually, that it was a video nasty. I had no idea the extent of it until, just a couple of years ago.
The film itself is kind of, I think, is kind of echoes in a way Last House on the Left.
Yeah.
Go on.
I like that film, and I like the company that made it. A friend of mine, when I was living in Venice, was worked for Esquire, and he was a very young guy, and he's the one who helped them publicize their films. Including one of his first job was publicizing Last House on the Left. And so he was a friend of a friend, and, he stayed at my studio when we were in Venice, and that was, prior to Don't Go in the Woods. But we used to spend a lot of time talking about exploitation and things like that, and I encouraged him to follow up with American International and go work for them. And he was afraid he was too young, and of course he wasn't. He did very well. So, yeah. So maybe that was part of the influence that we spent a lot of time talking about, his work and how he distributed and publicized, I guess you would say.
Definitely. And were there any other films that were like a big influence on you when you were making the movie?
Well, good question. I'm sure there were. I just can't think of the, because usually when I make a film, it starts with a vague idea and then I start pulling things. I think one of the influences that I was really surprised to see, because I shot the scene and edited it and was looking at it, and then I realized that I borrowed something from Touch of Evil. I didn't even know I had done it. It's when Akim Tomaroff is killed in Touch of Evil. I used a similar approach, shooting through the window and, down, looking down at him, and he's trying to get out the window.
Really cool. Well, we actually have another caller.
Okay.
Hold on 1 second. Let me put them on 315. Hello?
We have another caller.
Hello.
Let me put them on 315.
You can turn down your computer so we can not hear the echo of the thing. Hello, are you a fan of Jim's?
Yeah.
Are you one of the chat people or?
Yeah.
Okay, who's this?
The Saw Buffy one.
This is what? Oh,
Saul
Buffy?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
So,
well, hello, Saul Buffy.
Hello.
Yeah. Name. So you asked some interesting questions. Now, did you ask the Alma Ramos question?
Yes, I did.
Ah. So do you know Alma Ramos at all?
No, I just liked her scene the best in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she's very good. She's a natural, and I don't know where she is now. I think she's still in Salt Lake. But,
she's a natural at running and then getting killed.
yeah. Well, some people, you know, can't run and fall and, you know, do all those things. But she was very good at it. You know, I just said, okay, so here's where the camera will be, and you're tripping and you're falling here, and I was surprised. She's very good. Because
mm-hmm.
I thought, well, I'm going to have to edit or do something, you know. But I'll go ahead and try it. You know, I'll do a master shot. And it played out perfect. So.
Well, Ritterfan says that he's a friend of the Terror in the Forest MySpace that Saul Buffy had done.
Ah.
And but said that the one on YouTube is completely different. So
okay.
I guess have you not, or is this a feature film that you're doing?
No, it was like a home video.
So it was just kind of goofing and having fun with your friends?
Yeah, basically.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as Jim pointed out, he was, you know, Jim, you're a really big fan. You know, you love when fans go out and are inspired by you, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what it's all about. I mean, that's what we were doing in the 60s was, you know, just trying to encourage each other to go out and do it. So.
And then that's kind of great that you did that in the 60s, and then all of a sudden in the 80s is when you really started, you know, I guess the boom of independent filmmaking, you know,
right.
Really took off.
Yeah.
And now it's even crazier because anybody with a camcorder can go out and make a movie.
I know. It's amazing.
And some are great and some, you know, need kind of work.
Well, I know, but with that being people getting excited enough to go actually do it, somebody's going to, you know, change movies forever. You know, there's going to be a really great movie. It's going to change the world. I believe that. And somebody's out there doing it right now, and they're, you know, they're getting closer and closer to, you know, breaking through to a whole new, you know, approach to making films and having them mean something else. And
so, Saul Buffy, I wanted to know, for you, how did you hear about this interview? Was it just random?
A guy named Dustin Hubbard told me about it because he knew about Terror in the Forest.
Oh, nice. Yeah, he had, he actually did a movie called For Christ's Sake. So.
Ah. Okay.
He's actually going to be coming on our show on the, I believe, the 27th for his movie. But, you know, it's, he's kind of a fan of the show and stuff, and I've gotten a couple people that he's worked with, so.
Okay, good.
And, so I guess he had, you know, he'd been a fan of your MySpace, Saul Buffy. What's your name so we can say your... what's your first name at least?
Wayne.
Okay, Wayne.
Okay, so yeah, it feels better saying your actual name than just your stage name, your handle.
Yeah.
So, but have you ever, Wayne? Have you seen Zombiegeddon?
No, I did not.
Or heard of it?
No, I never heard of it.
Well, we Chris Watson is the one helping me interview co-host, and he had done that, and we were talking about how kind of now how influenced a lot of people are on the micro-budget world from people that have done you know, cult sensations like Hell Riders and, you know, Don't Go in the Woods.
Oh, that's cool.
So, yeah, so. Chris, are you excited about having to have anything to do with the sequel?
Oh, yeah. It happens. I think there's evidence by the success of the screenings and the DVD release. There's a wide fan base for the first one, so it'd do really well. And
any hints on what the sequel is going to have to do about, or is it just going to be completely random?
I've got a script. I've got the rough draft, so.
So it won't. But do you know how long it'll probably? It'll just depend on when the.
The German DVD company wanted to fund the sequel, and then for whatever reason they're spending their money somewhere else. So now I have to start over finding the cash to do it. So, but yeah, I wrote the script based on, you know, what they wanted to see in a sequel, and now they're making their money with something else. The German company just looked at Chris's film and Zombiegeddon, and apparently the distributor that he has sent them other films too. So I think they're you know, picking and choosing. So Trauma. So I guess they're gonna go with the Toxic Avenger or something. I guess that's what Germany needs, the Toxic Avenger.
So no more Video Nasties?
I guess not, yeah. Well, Video Nasties was an English thing, and so.
Was that just an English thing, or?
Yeah, that was part of the, you know, government stance on bad videos that were corrupting the, you know, the culture. So anyway,
so they shouldn't probably watch your the adult films that you've done.
Well, I don't know. I'm sure they did, because they did play in Europe, but that was a while ago. That was 1970 when they played there. So.
Well, so that was that was the thing. That was your first, you know, thing, right? You did adult films.
My first feature film was starring Titus Moody, if you know who he is. Maybe you're related.
No. But maybe I am. I don't know. I haven't seen it on my family tree yet, though.
Oh, okay.
But the first film, is that a adult film star, or?
Yeah, it was an adult film. I wanted to make an adult film that would sort of disturb people. I thought that was a valid approach, and so it did disturb people, and it was called The Dirtiest Game in the World, and it was a little political satire about the legalization of marijuana, and there were orgies and bloodletting and things like that.
Did you know that the guy who played what was his name on the in Last House on the Left, one of the guys in Last House on the Left, he's going to kill me because he was on the show. Fred Lincoln, who played Weasel on...
Right.
He is also... He's been an adult film director. Yes. I guess after... and he's made... Now, I don't know if you guys are going to get a kick out of this as much as I did when I heard it, but he did a bunch of Friday the 13th parodies.
Okay.
You know, and there was one like, there was something like Friday the 13th, Friday the 13th, The Nude Beginning.
Oh, okay,
like
I like it.
A Nude Beginning
so far.
And Yeah, there's parodies of Friday the 13th, and there's, I don't know, other things like that. There's like Last Whorehouse on the left or something.
Okay.
He did like, and he said he had more fun doing those than he did actually doing Last House on the Left.
Right.
Wow. You know, so I think that's really funny when he, you know, he goes out there to direct his own movies and he goes out and makes parodies because why not, you know?
Yeah, sounds good to me.
You know, do you look back and say that you kind of, would you at all miss doing adult films? Like nowadays it's like more okay to make those kind of things.
Right. Well, no, I made a few and then that's enough. You know, I really don't enjoy it like some people do. So, I mean, one of the last films adult films I made with Ron Jeremy. And, you know, that was fun, but, you know.
Now you can just make regular movies.
He's more excited by the whole concept, and he enjoys doing everything, and that's good. But, yeah, I just, yeah. I made them. I'm moving on.
So you're moving on to other genre.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's why I liked Hellrider so much. I always wanted to make a biker film. So.
And isn't that the fun part about directing different movies and whatnot, is getting a chance to take the movie that you're, you know, a big fan, you know, kind of the genre you're a big fan of, and be able to,
right,
to make your own.
Yeah. Well, I guess in saying, you know, the question you asked earlier about the inspiration for Don't Go in the Woods, and most of my films are inspired by the, you know, Roger Corman type pictures, because I really enjoyed his movies.
Roger Corman?
Roger Corman, yeah. And, you know, that's, I guess that would be the strongest influence. There are a lot of influences, but Roger Corman, that was, I guess, the answer to that question. And
he's still doing lots of stuff today, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's,
yeah.
I know he's got, he produced the Death Race movie.
Yeah.
That they remade, which that's a movie that should never have been remade, you know.
Okay.
But especially not by the guy who did Mortal Kombat.
Yeah.
You know.
All right.
I mean, so I just think it's kind of wrong that people would, do that. But, you know, because that's a, you know, that's one of my favorite of Roger Corman stuff. That and Little Shop of Horrors, which I think should be remade as a regular movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Well, that's that Roger Corman combination of Jack Nicholson and Roger Corman, you know, doing comedy, that really influenced me, because I think it was The Terror was the one I saw where Jack Nicholson was doing this horrible accent. He was playing a bad actor playing in a horror film. And I kept watching when I realized, wait a minute, he's acting. He's using the aesthetic of bad to do his art, and that's really what turned me around. I said, okay, I have to do this. I have to make bad movies, just like Roger Corman was doing and Jack Nicholson, because when you see Nicholson later, like in Little Shop of Horrors, you know, you see what he's doing. He's creating a character who's not only a character in the story, but is an actor in the film, you know. So he's playing it in different dimensions, and that really inspired me. So.
You know, it's funny. I heard an interview with Roger, and somebody asked him about Jack Nicholson and the fact that would he ever use, or has he ever tried to use Jack Nicholson today in his movies? And he said, of course he's tried, but Jack Nicholson said, oh, yeah, I'd love to do a movie for $3 million.
Yeah, well, that's it, yeah.
He can't do it for, you know, the budget that they used to make.
I know.
You know, so. It sucks, but, you know, at least he had them, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know,
Well, Roger Corman gave all these people a chance to, you know, do their first roles and be on film, and gave a lot of first-time directors their shot, and, you know. And some of the directors, you know, have Roger Corman, you know, appear in their films, so.
Yeah, and now people are remaking Roger Corman movies. Hollywood's remaking them, so. I mean, who knows how many more Roger Corman movies are going to get remade, you know?
True.
So I, that's what I'm surprised by. And, if he's going to produce something, he might as well have gotten Jack Nicholson to have a cameo in it.
There you go.
You know, that would have been cool, but maybe he tried and Jack was busy.
Yeah, I don't know.
Never know with this stuff.
Yep.
But, Chris, as far as your favorite movie of Jim's right now is Hellriders, did you say?
Yeah, I've always loved Hellriders, definitely.
And Wayne, how did you hear of Don't Go in the Woods Alone? Hello, Wayne, you still there?
Oh yeah. I don't really remember. I think I just rented it at Blockbuster Online.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know. So it's available there too, or?
I don't think at the store, only on the internet.
Yeah. I think you can get it through Netflix too. So.
Yeah, I know. We were mentioning before, I think when you're away, that you can get it on Netflix as instant viewing as well. So that's how I got a chance to watch it today before, before, you know, which is kind of cool because now I'll look down at the, it's, you know, how it tells you, thank you for returning this movie or whatever.
Yeah.
It says, thank you for returning Don't Go in the Woods Alone. Now, I know that was your original title for the movie, Don't Go in the Woods Alone. But did the company that produced or distributed it, did they actually put it out as Don't Go in the Woods, period?
Well, let's see. Originally, I didn't have a title, and I showed a rough cut to a producer in L.A., and he said, oh, you've got to call it Don't Go in the Woods. You can't call it anything else. I said, okay, that's what I'll call it. So that when the title went on, that's what it was. And the distributor at the time who finally ended up with it was Seymour Bordy and company and sons or associates. And they added the alone because that was a popular thing to do with films at the time to help sell them. You would add like a tagline that would become part of the title. So usually the tagline was like a commentary on the title or on the story, and they just, you know, added alone. They wanted to do that.
Well, I think was that the line in the movie, right?
Yes.
There was that line about don't go in the woods alone, right?
Right.
Decided to call it that. But so I had heard somewhere that you were the one that you preferred to Don't Go in the Woods Alone. But that's
Because that's, you know, that it was definitely part of that period of independent films and horror films, and I like that notion that they added that one word. You know,
that one word
on the title,
alone.
Yeah. Yes.
So I guess that's when you re-release it. That's what's going to be called. Don't Go in the Woods Alone.
I don't know. You know, that's a good question. They may leave the alone off. I don't know. Although it's on the art, you know, it's on the box cover or the.
The 25th anniversary edition.
Yes.
Yeah. It's got the dot, 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 too.
Right.
Alone.
Yeah.
And the tagline seems... Did you come up with the tagline, or...?
No, that was the distributor, because, I mean, that's what they do. They try to come up with ways to get people to go see it and to book it into theaters, and, you know, that's part of their magic, so...
Because there's the, everyone has nightmares about the ugliest ways, ugliest way to die.
I know.
I was kind of thinking about it, like, okay, it's kind of a random tagline.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's sort of one size fits all. They probably had good luck with it on other movies, so they just used it again.
Oh, you think so?
I think so, yes, because that's the way they did. You know, that's the way they did business. That's what they knew. So
Garth Eliason, he hasn't written anything since Don't Go Into
Well,
the
he's way. Written quite a few scripts. And I don't know. He had one that about a pterodon, a pterodactyl attack. And I think John Carpenter was making one just like it. I don't know if it ever got finished, but... He was a little disturbed by that. You know, the great minds were thinking alike. He did a vampire script that was pretty good, and he's written a few things. But
and how come it just hasn't?
It
how
hasn't
come
been,
he hasn't gone off his butt and directed himself? That'd be great.
Yeah, yeah. You well, know? He appears in a few films, but he says that, you know, he makes sure that he never has any dialogue. As long as he doesn't say dialogue, He'll appear in a film, so.
Chris, is he going to be in your next movie?
He's always welcome.
If we can get him to come down from Oregon, you know, he just might. Or if you went up there, I mean. You know.
Yeah.
So.
That's awesome. Yeah, definitely. And that's another thing I was going to say, because, you know, we were talking about how Felissa and Darren are fans, and how they're trying to help you basically get the stuff booked and everything. If you guys do the sequel, I think a lot of people would love it, and I bet they would love to have parts in it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've talked to Darren about that. I think he may be having other plans for producing films. I don't know. I mean, it seems a natural thing to do, you know, in the progression. But, I wrote a part for him in the script, if he wants to do it. So.
Huh. So well, that would be pretty cool if he could, help you out. So.
Right. Well, I know he wants to help in any way he can. I mean, he's willing to do it, but who knows? You know, it's like Jack Nicholson. Can I pay him enough to be in the movie? I don't know.
Well,
we'll
I
see.
Mean, I'm sure if he's a fan, I'm sure he'll work something out with you. And
well, I know, I'm pretty sure he will, but
yeah,
you know, he has
you
to.
You never know.
You never know.
Did we lose somebody again? Or yep, okay, we lost Wayne, I guess.
Oh, okay.
So, well, thank you, Wayne. If you want to keep asking questions, that's fine in the chat room, or if you want to come back on or whatever. Sorry, you didn't get a chance to say goodbye, but. How did you, the big question I have to ask about that also is how did you meet, Felissa and Darren?
Okay. Well, a lot of, my getting to know them is through Chris, and my getting to know Chris is through them. Darren, found Mary Gail Arts and became friends with her. And so, you know, he sort of tracked down everybody who's involved in Don't Go in the Woods.
Oh, for real?
Yeah. And so when we did the commentary, we went over to the house with Mary Gail and Darren.
Hmm.
We did it.
So who's on the commentary track for the first DVD release? I didn't actually get a chance to hear that yet, which I'm excited
okay.
when I
get. So it's myself and Darren and Mary Gail, and you'll have to help me out here, Chris. Darren's
David,
good buddy. His
yeah, David.
David, thank you. So we all got together and watched it and had a wonderful time.
That's great.
Yeah.
You, I mean, you know, do you think that pushed sales out a lot? Like,
yeah, there was a little sticker on the thing with, you know, CKY Darren Miller.
Huh.
It's sort of an introduction. And
huh.
So I did my own narration and or you know, commentary. So there are two commentaries.
I didn't
know if this is something that Code Red had worked out with Darren. So we all got together and did the bonus commentary.
Wow, cool. So that's really cool,
yeah.
though, that you guys got a chance to have him come on and kind of promote it. And it has since, has a lot of people talk to you, you know, like through the internet or any other thing, contacted you about the commentary and about.
Well, yeah, I get some responses, but not that many people. But
really?
Yeah, some people like it, some people don't. I don't know what that means. But I guess everybody gets a chance to give their opinion.
Especially
on the internet.
With the internet. So.
Yeah. So people either really love it or they really hate it. So I guess I've done my job.
Huh. One of the reviews I'm seeing, I'm laughing at the title for it, is Why It's Not a Good Idea to Ride a Wheelchair in the Woods.
Oh, okay.
It was just somebody had, I guess, remembered seeing it because they remembered the wheelchair, the
right.
random wheelchair guy. So.
Yes.
And that was, he had a really cool death scene to me, you know.
Well, yeah, he's pretty good, and he's still out there. I know he would be glad to come back and do it again, but we'll see.
Oh, yeah, the sound man.
Yeah.
So, and that must have been kind of cool, just kind of throwing people in the movie, that, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, he liked to, you know, be on the set, and that's why he was there. And he really enjoyed, you know, talking to everybody and running through the woods and all that. But it was a little difficult, so working up in the mountains. And it was kind of a high altitude, and it had a bad effect on people. Certain people got sick from altitude sickness, and when you go up and then come back down again, you feel ill, and it's the same thing as like jet lag. Part of that is the altitude change, you know, sort of gets to you. So everybody had to survive that, and so that was not easy. Getting used to that was the big thing, and also it was very low budget, so.
I think Wayne's calling back in. Hold on one second, please.
Okay.
Wayne, hello?
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay, Wayne.
Right, I guess your phone must have died, right?
Yeah, I had to use my cell phone.
Okay. Do you have any more questions for Jim?
Did he keep any props from Don't Go in the Woods?
Well, yes, and that's one of the extras, the monster's jingle stick. I'd forgotten one of the guy who plays Dick in the van, Dick and Cherry. He actually got away with it.
Hmm.
But a lot of the props have been appropriated by different people who wanted souvenirs and things like that. I don't think there's anything left. I couldn't find it. I started looking. But I believe different people who worked on the film have everything now.
How did you go about casting Tom Drury?
Well,
as the maniac.
Let's see. I knew Tom because he and his wife were entertainers. They were singing at different clubs around Salt Lake. And so I met him through other people who had used him in films, and I wanted him to play the maniac. So his commentary, of course, is that, you know, he's a classical sort of stage actor and has the training, and the only thing that he got to say in Woods was that big growl and yell. So he had no lines at all. So
kind of like Jason.
Yeah. So he's doing dinner theater now and doing musicals in Salt Lake. There's a big theater scene there. So
that's really cool, though.
Yeah.
The music, a lot of people always mention. You know, I've seen a lot of reviews and other things about the music. And, you know, how did you go about hiring a composer for the music, for the movie?
Well, that was the same thing. There was an individual there who did a lot of work for commercials and short films, you know, corporate type films. And people had recommended him, so we started out and he did what he usually did, and, you know, sort of very light kind of music, general sort of music. And I told him that what we really needed for this film was something along the lines of a John Carpenter score, and that was a place to start, but he could make it any way he wanted to. So he really got excited and, you know, did some great cues. And
so that's H. Kingsley Thurber?
Thurber, yeah. And he let's see, I guess that would be in the late 80s and early 90s. There was a lot of games were done in Salt Lake, and he did a lot of scores for different games at the time that people were developing. So he had sort of a career doing that. And of course, that business changed and they moved on, and he's still there. So
that's pretty cool, though.
Yeah.
And since you, you know, kind of were one of the cult staples of the 1980s in a way, would you say that you were a fan of people like Charles Band and David Dakota and people like that that were going out there?
Yeah, I like Charles Band. I liked what he did.
I think he does a little bit too many puppet movies.
Well, I know those are the ones that make the money, and he's very flamboyant personality, and, you know, just likes to be involved and, you know, do the deal, and, you know.
I just saw that there's a sequel to Ginger Dead Man that's coming out soon, called Ginger Dead Man 2: Passion of the Crust.
Okay.
So that's, you know, he's doing still pretty good with his production team.
Yeah. So, yeah, he knows how to play the game. He's very good at it. So.
You know, did you ever get a chance to meet him?
Yeah, well, I met him very, very early on. I mentioned Group One, you know, I was cutting trailers there, and he was doing his first films. His father, you know, was a screenwriter, and they worked together, and that's how he got started. So his father sort of set him up, Albert.
Yeah, and then Richard Band, his brother, did, like, a lot of, is still, from this day, does, like, a lot of music and stuff. And then I think his son, even, or something, like, is very big and did had his own, like, big Christian band or something, you know. Which I think is very ironic.
Yeah, so I saw him, and, you know, because he would be in the office all the time, so I saw him a couple of times and said hello, and he was off, you know, making this movie and the next movie and just kept going. So.
That's pretty cool, though.
Yeah.
Are you guys, you know... as far as fans of the films, are you guys anxious to see all the re-releases or releases of the films getting out there?
Oh yeah, yeah. I just, you know, once it started, I want to see how far it can go, and it seems to just be going. So.
How about you, Wayne and Chris?
Yeah, I'm excited. I definitely want to hopefully see Hellriders on DVD, and I think more people, you know, get a chance to see these that weren't around when they first came out, and that's the crowd that needs to see them.
Right.
Definitely. And how about you, Wayne?
I actually just bought the 25th anniversary edition, like, not too long ago.
Oh. Well, thank you.
That definitely helps out, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And hopefully the more money that it makes, does that go directly to you or to the distributors?
Well, it goes to the distributors and they pass it on. But, I mean, it fuels me, you know. I feel inspired when I see that, you know, somebody else has bought a DVD. So.
Will they, do they call you with the numbers and stuff like that, or?
Yeah, every so often we keep in touch, and you know, they have questions and things like that, and so.
Yeah, I've never understood how that really works. Now, Chris, when you did Zombie Gen, Chris, you know, that was distributed by Troma, so.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of a different company than somebody, you know, like. You know, like they're a different company. They're from what I've understood, that, you know, do they keep in touch with you about Zombiegen's numbers and stuff like that?
The numbers, you know, a little bit. I don't really bother too much on it, honestly, but because everything, you usually hear the stories, you get what you get up front, and that's about it with a lot of companies. So. I've just kind of gone off that and use it for what I can.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing. I mean, I guess, you know, the distributors, I've never really understood about, you know, what they do. And, I mean, how do you even, like, go about finding one? Do you want to answer that, Jim?
Oh, okay. Well, I can talk about what I knew. There, it's totally different now, because in the 70s, what you would do is you would find a distributor or a sub-distributor, you know, somebody who distributed in the Boston area or the Atlanta area, and you would interest them. So I knew a few people who were doing distribution on that, you know, on that level, on the independent level, so I would talk to them and show them films that I had made, and together we would work it out, you know, so that it would be the kind of thing that they could sell. So that would mean, you know, changing the, you know, the advertising or the poster or the trailer, and so that's what I did. I learned a lot from the same person that Albert and Charles Band learned from. So I spent a lot of time learning, you know, how group one's approach. But now it's videotape DVD, and it's a little bit different. The business is different. It's more like the music business, and, you know, because you have to get those little DVDs into the stores, and that is a business all by itself. So Code Red and Troma are the distributors, but at the same time, they have to have a distributor to actually get it on the shelf. So they're two distributors now.
Oh, shoot. Looks like we lost Chris.
We lost Chris?
Yeah, I'm hoping he calls back in a little bit, but...
Oh, okay.
Anyway, the thing is, how did you find Code Red?
They approached me. They were thinking about setting up a company. And they started talking and said, you know, we've made all these films, and would you be interested? And they inspired me to go find the negative. The negative was lost. It was in a warehouse somewhere, and nobody knew where it was. because in the 70s and the 80s, when you made a film like a low-budget film, it existed for a while, and then, you know, it was gone, and people would sell off the final foreign rights to be shown in another country. They would, to save money, to make a little extra money, they would sell the original negative. So, you know, they did things like that, because otherwise it didn't have a life after that. It was an old movie. Nobody wanted to see it.
So they
put it together. Code Red put it together, and they came to me and said, "We would like to release your film, or as many films as we can get of yours." I said, "Fine, let's do it."
So how did they approach you? Did they call you, or?
Yeah, they called me, and the way they found Don Jones is, they were saying, "Well, do you know Don Jones?" I said, "Well, yeah, I talked to him years and years ago, and his number was still in one of my books, so I gave him the number, and it worked." So they got in touch with him.
Huh. That's really cool, though.
Yeah, so that's how they found The Forest, or that's how they found Don Jones to get The Forest.
And so then they got you, so they got The Forest and they got you as well, or?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh.
So,
that's pretty cool. And they weren't the original distributor, were they?
No, they Don't Go in the Woods was through Seymour Bordy and Associates, a real sort of, you know, one-man band, father and son, I guess, on Highland and Hollywood. And, you know, they were, they started out over in Vermont, you know, Film Row, and where all those people used to make the trailers and the one sheets to sell a movie, and that's where they worked from.
Oh,
you know, David Friedman was their landlord.
We have another caller. Hold on, let me bring it up real quick. 941, hello?
Hello?
Hello, 941?
Hi.
Hi, who's this?
This is Dustin.
Oh, Dustin, hi, how are you doing, man?
Hey, I'm good, how are you?
Pretty good. You're talking with myself and Jim.
Hello, Dustin. It's Jim Bryan here.
Hey, nice to hear you. I wanted to call in and ask about, I know there was talk about the sequel.
Yes.
Or Don't Go in the Woods.
Right.
Who is necessarily involved in that? I know you said Chris Watson was going to be involved.
Yes.
Is and, he writing and directing or?
Producing.
Producing. And are you going to actually take the helm of the sequel?
Yeah, that's what I would like to do. And Chris can back me up. If
Wish
I can't
Chris
get to the top
here.
Of the mountain, then he'll have to go.
Wish
Very
he was
cool.
still here to discuss that. I guess his phone must have died, too. So. But, but Wayne's here, too, I guess, still. Aren't you, Wayne?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
So Wayne,
is the sequel to Don't Go in the Woods going to be based on the baby from the first one?
Yes. The baby will be grown up, and she will be adopted by
Monster?
The brother of the maniac. The brother and the fiancé of the maniac. So.
Wait, so was that a setup that I didn't get when I watched the movie, or was that just a kind of a made-up setup for the sequel?
Well, yeah, it's a setup in the movie, of course, and I just used that character because I set that problem up for myself when I wrote it.
Well, did you think it was going to get a possible sequel, you know, right when you first made it?
Well, those things sometimes happen, but there wasn't any interest at the time. They wanted something else because at the time everybody was saying action adventure. Now horror is back, but I mean there are many more horror films than there were at the time.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Right. So there could be a sequel. at all different levels, you know. I don't know.
I think that was the thing for the Toxic Avenger, because Lloyd Kaufman had read an article saying that a horror film was dead. So he, you know, later on it was like, oh, well, the horror film is not dead.
Mm-hmm.
Still, you know, it's just taking a little.
Well, I mean, it wears itself out. You know, people get tired of seeing horror films, and then it jumps right up again.
Yep.
They always come back.
Well, as long as something's original and different, and, you know, it has a style, you know. The Japanese horror films seem to be, you know, big these days.
Oh, yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
So that's the thing, and people want to mimic whatever's popular at the time.
Yeah,
so,
I like the new Hills Have Eyes.
The Part 2?
Yeah, I like that.
I haven't actually seen it, but wasn't it like written by Wes and his son?
Yeah.
So that's a pretty cool thing right there.
Right.
It's just at least they went out and did something. It was their movie, so if anybody says, you know, that it's not anything like that, you know, like, not, you know, why would Wes approve of that? You know, he's the one who wrote it, so.
Right.
All the blame's on him.
Oh, okay. Well, you had asked about, the kind of horror film I'd like to do, or I think that's what you were asking. But anyway, I had written a script about, you know, zombies in outer space, and that one's coming back to me these days. I'm being re-inspired by that idea. So there'd be zombie planet, you know. It's like everybody's done it, but I want to do it too.
That's pretty cool, though. Is that eventually something that you have written anything for, like even a treatment or?
Yeah, no, I wrote a script, and, you know, I was flogging it, trying to get, you know, promoting it, trying to get the funding, but it sort of passed by, and now it would work now, I think, in terms of what people want to distribute, and that's always the problem. It's how the distributors, whoever they are, see the market, you know, and you're sort of stuck with that. So you can work on an idea, and then it's just not, you know, nobody sees the glory of it, or the financial possibilities, and so that's always what I've been doing, waiting for the right time to do the right show. So you have to move fast. You have to be a little bit ahead of the curve. You never know.
So how come it's, because I noticed that there's a big gap between now and the last time you made Lady Street Fighter, which was one of your last films.
Right.
Just getting funding, or what was that?
Just getting funding. I spent a number of years, you know, writing scripts and getting together and working with other people on their scripts and promoting. And, you know, I always had an idea, and I've always been trying to get something going. But, a lot of things have changed in terms of how movies are made and who goes to see them. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, the digital revolution and all that, how, you know, just the approach to making films is different in a lot of ways. And that changes, and you, as a filmmaker, you have to change with it, or, you know, be in advance of the changes. So that's what I've done, is try to keep up. But I started building a house and doing other things, and will take up a lot of your time. So.
That's really cool. Well, I guess before this show ends, which is supposed to be like about 7 minutes. The one thing I want to know also is, I guess Lady Street Fighter, we just brought up. We didn't really talk too much about that.
Yeah.
And that was, I guess, your last film that you've done.
Well, actually, that was done a few years ago, and it was distributed on the Kung Fu circuit. back in the day, and it was put out on videotape later. So the date that is, you know, used for it on IMDb is actually a re-release. But a lot of the things were never in print, so they don't appear on the internet.
Hmm.
So that's just the, you know, the date that it got stuck with, because that was one of its releases on videotape, and it wasn't the first one.
That wasn't the first one of it. So
yeah.
Though I guess the release that says on like IMDb is 1985.
Right. So that's actually a video re-release, but that's the one that, you know, that got picked up.
Hmm. And that's the one that stars Trace Carradine.
Right. Yeah.
Which I think that's an awesome idea that you were saying earlier.
Right.
Trace, you know, that there, you know, you can make up a Carradine.
Right, make up a star. There were so many of them, I thought I could get away with it.
did it work?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying to look at if Lady Street Fighter is actually still available, and is it like on Amazon or anything, or?
I don't think it's still available. It would have to be put on DVD, and then people would actually consider buying it.
Are you gonna?
So there is a contract with Code Red for them to release it, but they have so many things to do. I don't know when they'll get around to the rest of the Jim Bryan collection. So I don't know which one they're going to do. If they could get Hellriders, they'd do it. Or even Executioner 2. They would they'd be happy to release it.
Release like a Jim Bryan box set.
Right. Well, I think they're going to make more money if they do them one at a time. I think that's their approach. So, but they have so, you know, many things going, and who knows which one will be more successful, and that's, they'll follow that line as long as they can. So anyway.
Yeah, that's really cool, though. Hopefully there will be a lot more films coming out from, you know, Code Red of yours.
Oh, yeah. Well, they've got plenty going. I mean, they can, you know, they just barely survive because they're both working so hard trying to get all these, you know, extras together and record people. And, you know, there's a lot of work trying to find all the elements, you know, tracking down the things, but they're the ones who got me to, you know, start asking around and find out where the composite original was for Don't Go in the Woods, because I thought it was lost forever. And they kept asking, and, you know, so, I'll ask this guy, you know. And I kept calling, and finally I found it. And I was really surprised that it was still there. So it got damaged in the earthquake, but the composite, you know, the inner negative is in good shape. So the original negative got all banged up and damaged and can't be used, but could actually make a new print today. So.
Yeah, especially with Final Cut Pro and everything, like the digital way of doing things on, like, computer. Anyway, well, it's, you know, close to being the end of the show. Dustin or Wayne, do you guys have any other questions before we close?
What was one of your favorite memories on the film?
On the film Don't Go in the Woods?
Yeah.
I would have to say it was getting the last shot with all the actors, because we had to go up the hill into the mountains every day, and boy, that was tired. I was tired. So if it rained or snowed, and it happened like every other day, the weather was different. And, you know, the fact that we just finished, that we actually made it, was the miracle. So... It was a very difficult film to do. So it was like going on, exploring for National Geographic and making a horror film at the same time.
So it was definitely worth it.
Well, thanks.
Well, thank you so much, Wayne, for calling in. And everybody should check out your Terror in the Forest.
Okay, we will.
And Dustin, your show.
Love Talk Radio.
Okay. Your show is going to be your show is going to be on the 27th. So.
Yes, I can't wait.
Yeah, so that's,
okay.
That should be really fun to hear that. And for some reason it says that my show is on but not streaming, so that's interesting.
Well, I think you came to the end of your time.
Yeah. It doesn't really tell you too much until it actually happens, and then all of a sudden it just tells you, it's over.
Okay, well, I guess.
So, but thank you so much, Jim, for definitely, it was really great to hear from you.
Okay, good to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm glad you got a chance to talk to Chris and everything. I think that's, I think it's great that you found somebody out there that can help you produce.
I really like Chris, and we have a good time when we get together, so it'll be fun to work with.
Yeah, and he's a really big independent guy, so.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I'm hoping he can get out and make more movies soon. And
oh, he will be. I mean, he's unstoppable.
They've both made great movies.
Thanks.
Both of Chris's movies that I saw, Slaughter Party and Zombiegetting, are both fun. I really look forward to you coming back into the directing field, Mr. Bryan.
Okay.
So I think the two of you will make a great team.
Thanks, Dustin, for saying that about Jim. So.
I'm really looking forward to it. So.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you guys, and we're gonna have to close this off. But just know that next week I'm gonna have Donald Farmer on to talk about his film Chainsaw Cheerleaders, which stars like Tiffany Shepis and
great
Jackie
title.
Hall.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I mean, these days people can. Title alone, people will check it out, and posters.
Right.
They've got a MySpace site on it. So.
Okay.
Well, I don't know who else will be on there, but from what I've heard, Jackie Hall from the Howard Stern Show might actually come on the show, and people like that he's going to try to talk to try to come on, so that were involved with the movie. So some of the Chainsaw Cheerleaders themselves.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me.
No problem, Jim. And I'm really looking forward to your to the remakes and the sequels and the other stuff that come, of all these movies.
Okay, so goodbye to Chris and Wayne and Dustin, right?
Right.
All right, well, bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
All right, have a nice night.
Okay.
Well, all right. Thank you guys for listening to the show, and I can't wait to hear what you guys' thoughts about this movie, the show was, and everything that's going on. Tune in next week for the Donald Farmer Chainsaw Cheerleader show, and after that, we've got It Came from Trafalgar show on the Monday right after that, so after the Sunday, so... You'll start seeing more stuff about that on my MySpace, so go check out my MySpace at myspace.com/JonathanMoody will rock you. Thank you.